Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back, everybody, to the XCast X-Files Podwatch. We're at episode 58. We're getting towards the end of the fifth season as we're talking about the entire run of the X-Files up until My Struggle 2 as we wait for new episodes next year. Today we're covering All Souls and the Pine Bluff variant. I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and Chris Knowles is back with me. Hey, Chris.
Hey.
So at this point, the clock's really running down on the Vancouver era of the series.
Sadly, yes.
Very sadly. I can't remember the exact chronology. So, like, when was the actual decision taken? When did everybody find out, you know?
I think Chris Carter made the announcement when they were shooting the William Gibson episode.
Okay, Killswitch.
Killswitch, yeah. I believe that's when the announcement was made. And he broke down in tears.
Oh, really?
During the meeting, he really did not want to leave Vancouver. He was very upset about it.
Well, they found their way back there eventually, but it took a while. LA's another story, but we'll get to that another day. Today, we're talking about All Souls, which is episode 17 of the fifth season. This aired in April of 1998. And the credits are, it's a story by Billy Brown and Dan Angel, a teleplay by Frank Spotnitz and John Scheiben, and directed by Alan Coulter. And this is the episode which sees Scully, who's experiencing visions of a dead daughter, Emily, becoming involved in an investigation involving so-called Nephilim, the children of angels and mortal women. Okay, so this kind of closes out the Emily arc, I suppose. She's never spoken of again. Is this kind of a fitting conclusion to that storyline, would you say?
Yeah, I think so.
So what do you think of this episode as a whole?
Oh, I like it very much. I know a lot of people don't like it at all, but I like it quite a bit.
What is it about this episode, then, that speaks to you? What exactly do you like about it?
Well, first of all, I'm very familiar with all the theology and mythology behind it. You know, I really was very tickled to see this kind of thing being discussed on the show. Secondly, a lot of it, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time is Jacob's Ladder, the Adrian Lyne film with Tim Robbins. This movie, like, I don't know if it was a direct response to that, but so much of it reminds me, you know, particularly the ending. The climax is essentially just a straight out lift from Jacob's Ladder. So I really appreciated that too. You know, it's funny in the context of the X-Files, the lifts and the tributes and, you know, however you want to term them, seem clever and winking rather than just like, oh, they're just ripping this off, you know, whatever. You know, I was very familiar. I had done a lot of reading into these kind of topics, you know, Gnostic Gospels, heretical Christianity, the early church, this mythology of the angels and the watchers and all these sort of things that people who watch the episode may not realize this, but, you know, this ties in the Nephilim have a very strong tie into UFO lore, because a lot of people who interpret UFO phenomena put it in the context of the Nephilim and the fallen angels and things like that. So I thought it was very clever how they conjoined the two, you know, and not in a you know, another series would be just like very blatant and very obvious, and you know, here it's more subtle and knowing and, you know, insinuating. So I really enjoyed that.
It's interesting you say that, because I didn't know that. But when I was watching this, it reminded me a little of the way that in Patient X and The Red and the Black, you know, we find out there's this kind of galactic battle, and that Earth is kind of, you know, one of the battlegrounds, you know, and it's all raging above us. And here we've got something not entirely dissimilar, where you've got, you know, these heavenly beings and, you know, and the flip side of that.
No, I think that's intentional. And tell you why. I mean, remember that everything in the X-Files is point of view. What you're seeing may not be necessarily objective reality, but somebody's perception of objective reality. So put this in the context of, you know, the X-Files, you know, they drop hints throughout the series. They don't want to tell you everything explicitly. They want you to sort of figure things out for yourself. So I don't think it's by any means a coincidence or an accident that they dropped this storyline in, particularly dealing with Emily's sort of her denouement here. It's intentional because they're telling this whole story, the war in heaven. You know, Father Gregory talks exactly about the war in heaven. That same theme is picked up again with Absalom in the eighth season. You know, you sort of have to tie these strands together. And basically what this episode is, and I think a lot of people don't understand it, is that this is a mythology episode as perceived by people who don't see alien phenomena and UFOs and things like that through a, you know, cosmological context, but through a religious context. So, I mean, that's why I think this episode is so great. Like, do I really think, you know, in an objective sense that these girls, these, with, you know, the polydactyl and things like that were really meant to be the children of angels? No, I think what they're really saying is that these girls were part of some alien hybrid program that didn't work out. And, you know, if you look at the way they're taken, you know, and these lights from heaven and these figures, you know, appearing in the middle of the street and things like that. I mean, all these same motifs show up in UFO lore. So they don't want to come out and tell you precisely that that's what they're doing, but that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah. And of course, then it makes sense that somebody like Scully would come along and interpret it the way she does, I suppose. Yeah, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. I never quite saw it like that. Yeah,
I mean, do this, go to YouTube, you know, go to the search function and put in UFO and Nephilim. You're gonna get maybe 300,000 hits back on that search. Seriously.
I think the episode works even if you're not steeped in all that stuff, you know, because I quite like the episode. You've got this framing device of the scenes in the confessional, and I believe they were added quite late in the day. And I don't know, I guess the episode feels a little padded to me.
I think it was running short. I think what this was is that the original script was written by two freelancers and then was kind of rewritten. I think it was one of these, like, on the fly, they didn't have enough pages, you know, things like that. Or there were scenes that they didn't like, things like that.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, what you're picking up on is definitely, you know, a part of the process there.
So there is something to it then. So one story I came across was that they sort of dumped, I think the number was seven new script pages on Gillian Anderson for one of those scenes. And they said, we're going to film this tomorrow. And she said, look, if it's going to be a good performance, I need a bit more time. And the shooting of that scene did get delayed a day or so, I believe. So I thought that was interesting that obviously she cared so much about the performance. She wanted to get it exactly right. As ever, it's a very good performance by her.
And by the way, I believe the priest is played by John Patrick Finn, who one of the line producers of the show. So, I mean, that's maybe how last minute it was that they couldn't even cast the part. They had to just say, John, can you play the priest? You can do that, right?
I believe what they did actually is they filmed his side the day that they were supposed to film Gillian's. And then she got the next day to do her side of it. I believe that's what happened. And there's some other good guest star performances. I mean, there's an actor who turns up here, Glenn Morshower, who plays the character of Starkey, Aaron Starkey. I've seen him in a few things. I think he's a good actor.
Yeah, he's very good. He usually plays military men.
Yeah, he had a long role on 24 as like the president's kind of head bodyguard or something. Yeah, he's very solid. You know, when he turns up, he's always good. I mean, sometimes this feels a bit like a Millennium episode. I don't know if you think that's fair. It feels like something that could easily be retooled and could have appeared on Millennium at certain points during that show's history.
Yeah, particularly during the second season.
Yeah, when Morgan and Wong were at the helm.
Yeah, you know, at that time, in other words. Here's the thing. I mean, Glenn Morgan actually had said that in ways that people don't necessarily recognize that Millennium had a very strong influence on the X-Files. Mm. You know, all the writers, of course, are working in the same building. So, I mean, you know, they're going to the same meetings. They're all watching the same dailies. And this is, I think this is a case, you know, for all we know, that original pitch may have been a Millennium pitch. I mean, who knows? The way these scripts evolve is you know, a process that would, you know, just bog your mind, because the credited writer on a script, you know, actually wrote a screenplay that had absolutely nothing to do with what you're seeing on screen.
Yeah.
And this is the way it played out. And, you know, it could be argued in the same regard that Millennium is exactly what I was saying this episode was, is that Millennium is looking at this whole war in heaven and this approaching apocalypse, you know, from an entirely different context. But it's all part of the same phenomenon, you know, and it's like, how do you perceive this? Do you perceive this through a religious or spiritual context, which, you know, millions of people around the world do?
Yeah.
Or do you see this from, you know, sort of a sci-fi, cosmological context? Take your pick. Some people do both.
All right, so The Pine Bluff Variant is episode 18 of season 5. May 98 is when it was broadcast, and it was written by John Scheiben, directed by Rob Bowman. This is the episode that sees Mulder, initially unbeknownst to Scully, going undercover to infiltrate a militia group who have access to a lethal contagion. Yeah, this is a very, very good episode, in my view. It's a very interesting premise, and I believe John Scheiben wanted to do it for a long time, which was, you know, Mulder goes undercover. I believe maybe he pitched it a few times, and then finally they find the right place to put it. So I like the way this ties in as well to Patient X, where he'd spoken, where Mulder had spoken at that convention on the panel, and apparently that had his disenchantment there had led him to be on the radar of this militia group. What do you think about this episode, Chris?
Oh, it's phenomenal. I mean, the great thing about this episode is that it's entirely non-fictional. I mean, everything that they're dealing with here is taken from fact and reality. You know, there's no paranormal or science fictional episode elements here. This is the X-Files working straight from the headlines. You know, far-right militia groups, government infiltration and control of militia groups, you know, live testing of biotoxins on the public. I believe some of the revelations about that came out at least maybe a year or two earlier. I think they referenced that in an episode. I forget which one it is exactly. I think it's Tolico, where they talk about the you know, the government tests where you know, people in hospitals were injected with plutonium and all these diseases and horrible things. So everything in this episode is based in reality, and that's what makes it so incredibly scary. See, you know, I like to tell people, it's like, I'm not afraid of vampires or Jason or Freddy or, you know, you name it. Those things don't scare me. What scares me is stories like this, like the Pine Bluff Variant, because it's so reality-based. I mean, it's just taking elements from the headlines, from the newspapers, and creating a story about it. And it's, you know, the credibility of that, you know, that is what really scares me.
Mm.
You know, I mean, one of the scariest movies I ever saw, it was Training Day with Denzel Williams and Ethan Hawke. And it's like, it was so scary because it's so real that you know, these kind of things happen all the time. You know, that scene when he's left with the gang members who specialize in killing and disposing of bodies and things like that. I mean, that whole thing is terrifying. And you know, that same principle applies to this episode, because, like, if you're watching this episode and, you know, you're not necessarily familiar with the background here, you know, just be aware that everything they're depicting is absolutely real and absolutely happened. Not in this context, I mean, not in the sequence, you know, but all the different things that are going on here are all based on the news.
It's a terrifying idea that something like this could happen and
is happening,
and how much damage can be done with these kind of pathogens. It's interesting, I think, to look at some of the influences that went into this episode. Scheiben's talked about, I believe, the influence of John le Carré's fiction, specifically The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. I think it also looks, I mean, the episode visually looks like a great kind of 70s paranoid thriller, something like The Parallax View or All the President's Men, it kind of in that lineage, I suppose. And I've also seen this compared to the films of Michael Mann, something like Heat. But actually, this feels like a forerunner of a 24 episode to me, you know. I mean, 24 doesn't come along for another few years, but some of the style and the sort of the way this episode carries itself feels a lot like that series to me.
I think that's a, you know, it's a very fair point. Let me just add this. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you wonder, like, you know, the producers of 24, did they watch that episode and think, you know, there's a really good germ here for a series. Let's think about this. Let's expand on this. You know, let's develop this. You know, it's the same phenomenon with Fringe, where it's like Fringe just took, you know, just watched episodes that were all based in, you know, Fringe science and things like that, genetic experimentation, you know, not necessarily paranormal, not necessarily alien, and said, let's build an entire series concept on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I was just going to point out, so obviously Rob Bowman's the director here. There's a shot here. It's when they get to the bank towards the end of the episode. So they have the establishing shot of the bank, and then we're inside, and it's all in one take. It's a shot that starts on the bags of money. It goes over to the bank manager, who sort of walks around, and he goes out the back to where the truck comes, and then the guys get out the truck with the guns, you know. It's all in one shot. It's like something out of a Scorsese film or something. It's elaborate if you watch it, but it doesn't draw too much attention to itself, but it really clearly, like, delineates the visual geography of this setting, you know. And I don't know, I think Rob Bowman, I mean, he's one of the best directors who worked on The X-Files. His work here is outstanding, I think. Bowman, this is right at Bowman's alley, I would say, this kind of story.
Oh, tailor-made for him. And this is the kind of thing that he really loved to direct. What you're seeing here is, again, I mean, this is a feature film, you know, chopped down to 45 minutes. And it's kind of funny because, so a feature film, a lot of it is padded with exposition and establishing the characters and, you know, establishing the universe that this is all taking place in. The great strength of The X-Files is that they didn't have to do that. You know, that was already done. That's been done for X amount of episodes prior to this. So, I mean, all the scenes that you see in the Pine Bluff variant are like all the best scenes in like a 70s conspiracy movie. Off the top of my head, The Parallax View or 3 Days of the Condor, or, you know, these kind of films. It's just as powerful. It's just as, you know, rendered. It's just as delineated. You get all the information, you get all the impact, you get all the really memorable scenes, but you don't have to spend all this time setting everything up. You can just get straight to the story, straight to the action. So I just think this is a tremendous piece of work, you know, on par with any of the best 70s movies.
Do you think this is John Scheiben's best solo episode, you know, best episode that he's credited to as a solo writer?
That's kind of tough to say.
I think it may well be.
Yeah, what are your runners up?
I think The Walks maybe a little underrated. I think that's not too bad. What else did he do? I mean, I think Scheiben's somebody who gets a lot of unfair criticism from the fans, you know, because I think, I suppose people latch on to Teso dos Bichos and El Mundo Gira. But I would say maybe his contributions, when there's an episode that's written by two or three people, are probably kind of, a lot of people airbrush him out in their minds, I would suggest. I don't know if that's true. I get the sense if there's an episode that's Vince Gilligan and John Scheiben, I think a lot of people treat it as a Vince Gilligan episode, even if that's a bit unfair.
No, I think that is very much unfair. I think, another John Scheiben is SR.
Is it SR? Yeah, A1T? Yeah, kind of, you know, in a similar style.
Similar vein, yeah. 70s conspiracy, really, really effective. Really hits those notes. I think, yeah, I would, you know, this is probably personally my favorite John Scheiben episode. Everybody's going to have their own, but this is a definite highlight of the season. You know, again, this is that machine firing on all cylinders. You know, this is a perfectly lubricated, tuned up engine just burning down the street. It's just astonishing to watch. I mean, all these episodes, a lot of these standalones, you know, Mind's Eye, things like that, they're so effective and they really stand on their own. I mean, like, they are true standalones. So, you know, people sort of say, you know, Monsters of the Week are standalones. Well, maybe not, because they tie into this whole overarching mythology of the paranormal and things like that. You know, an episode like Pine Bluff Variant, like Mind's Eye, in a different time, in a different place, the plot lines here would be feature films and would be like, you know, moderately successful feature films or maybe even very successful feature films. And that is like they truly stand alone because they don't need to have an understanding of this whole world of where vampires are actually real. It's just like, no, they stand alone. And that's, you know, Wet Wired is another perfect example of that.
Yeah, well, like we were talking about 24, I mean, 24 season 3 is basically, I mean, it's stretching it a bit. But it's basically the Pine Bluff variant stretched out to 24 episodes of TV, you know.
Yeah, no, you're right, definitely.
They got a lot of mileage out of it, definitely. All right, I guess we should wrap up there, unless you wanted to add anything else on this episode, Chris?
No, again, an episode that you don't hear a lot of people talking about, and an episode that I think everybody should watch because it is just a fantastically entertaining and terrifying, you know, 45 minutes of your time.
Yes, I would echo that. And if anyone was planning to skip over this to get to the end of the fifth season, I would strongly ask you to strongly urge you to reconsider, because I think this is a very good episode indeed. What have we got tomorrow? Let's have a look. So tomorrow's episodes are Foliager and The End. In the meantime, listeners, we're on Twitter at @X_cast. We're on Facebook. If you type in XCast, you'll find us there. Until next time, trust no one.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.